Soon after my return from America, in the first year of the Manin era, I brought out my first publication, a dictionary of the English language, which I called Kei Tsugo, and which made a beginning for my series of later books. For the next 2 or 3 years, I was more occupied with my struggles in studying English than teaching. Then, in the second year of Bunkyo, a happy opportunity came my way, and I was able to make a visit to Europe with the envoys sent by our government. I received an allowance of some 400 ryu, and as our expenses on the tour were to be borne entirely by the ministry, this income was entirely for my own use. And so, being a man who did not need much money, I thought of using it elsewhere. I took 100 ryu of the amount and sent it to my mother, back in our native town. While I was away in America, the officious people of Nakatsu had been giving vent to rumours about me. One had coolly reported that I was dead in the foreign country. In the full swing of the anti-foreign sentiment, there was nothing we could do. We had to endure everything and keep quiet. I was really very sorry for my mother in all this situation. Sending her some money would not make up for my long absences, but still, 100 ryu was an enormous sum of money for both of us, never seen in all our previous lives. So I sent it to her with the best intentions. We sailed in December, still the first year of Bunkyo, on an English war vessel, the Odin, sent over for the purpose of conveying our envoy. There were about 40 men in the party. Among the men of general utility, there were several samurai from various clans who had privately requested the officials to take them along as servants. We all wore our Japanese dress with a pair of swords in our girdles, and appeared on the streets of London and Paris in such attire. A sight indeed it must have been. When we reached Paris and had been formally received by the welcoming French officials, the first request we had to make was that as many of our party as possible be accommodated near the chief envoy's camp, because of our number and the amount of our baggage. The heads of the mission were evidently anxious, because if different members of the party were scattered in remote hotels, it might be inconvenient and unsafe in a strange land. The host of the welcoming committee understood, nodded his approval, and asked the number of our party. When he was told it was 40, he replied, "Well, if you are only 40, why, one of our hotels could accommodate 10 or 20 times that number." We did not comprehend what he meant, but on reaching the hotel assigned to us, we found that he was not jesting. Our headquarters were the Hotel de Louvre, opposite the entrance to the Imperial Palace. It really was a huge edifice of 5 stories, with 600 rooms and over 500 employees. More than 1,000 guests could be accommodated at one time. Instead of our anxiety lest the party might be separated in distant hostelries, our real anxiety became the possibility of losing our way in the maze of halls and corridors in the one hotel. Numerous gas lights served to illuminate the rooms and halls so that we could not distinguish at all the coming of darkness outside. In the dining hall there was such a spread of food, of both the woods and the sea, that even those in the mission who professed their dislike of foreign objects could not maintain this aversion in the choice of food. The joke was in the stock of Japanese supplies brought along in our baggage. We could not cook our rice in the kitchen of the hotel, nor was it possible within reason to use our oil wick lamps in the halls. Finally, exhausted with all the useless impediments, we piled it all up in an apartment and offered the entire store of rice, oil lamps, and everything to one of the lesser members of the welcoming committee, and asked him to take it for free. As we were unfamiliar with Western life and customs, there was naturally no end of the farcical situations occurring among our party. When one of the Lord Envoys had occasion to use the toilet, he was followed to the doorway by one of his personal attendants, who carried the lighted paper lantern, as is the custom in our homeland. The attendant, in his most formal dress, was to be seen squatting patiently outside the open door, holding his master's removed sword. This happened to be in the bustling corridor of the hotel, where people were passing constantly, and the gas was burning as bright as day. But, unperturbed, sat the faithful guardian. I happened to come along and see the incident, which I ended by shutting the doors. Then turning to the man, I told him quietly of the etiquette of the Europeans on such occasions, but my heart was fluttering with consternation. Of the political situation of that time, I tried to learn as much as I could from various persons that I met in London and Paris, though it was often difficult to understand things clearly, as I was as yet so unfamiliar with the history of Europe. However, I find now, as I look in my diary, the mention of Napoleon III as a very powerful figure, said to be the greatest statesman of all Europe at that time. Then I find mention of a great growing power, Prussia, the neighbouring country, with her influence spreading like a rising sun. The wars with Austria and the problem of Alsace-Lorraine were constantly discussed, and I remember they were made the subject of prophecy by many men. While we were in London, a certain member of the Parliament sent us a copy of a bill which he said he had proposed in the House under the name of the party which he belonged. The bill was a protest against the arrogant attitude of the British minister to Japan, Alcock, who had at times acted as if Japan were a country conquered by military force. One of the instances mentioned in the bill was that of Alcock's riding his horse into the sacred temple grounds of Shiba, an unpardonable insult to the Japanese. On reading the copy of this bill, I felt as if a load had been lifted from my chest. After all, the foreigners were not all devils. I had felt that Japan was enduring some pointed affronts on the part of the foreign ministers who presumed on the ignorance of our government. But now that I had actually come to the minister's native land, I found that there were among them some truly impartial and warm-hearted human beings. So, after this, I grew even more determined in my doctrine of free communication with the rest of the world. A perplexing institution was representative government. When I asked a gentleman what the election law was and what kind of an institution the Parliament really was, he simply replied with a smile, meaning, I suppose, that no intelligent person was expected to ask such a question. But these were the things most difficult of all for me to understand. In this connection, I learned that there were different political parties, the Liberal and the Conservative, who were always fighting against each other in the government. For some time, it was beyond my comprehension to understand what they were fighting for, and what was meant, anyway, by fighting in peacetime. This man and that man are enemies in the house, they would tell me. But these enemies were to be seen at the same table, eating and drinking with each other. I felt as if I could not take much out of this. It took me a long time with some tedious thinking before I could gather a general notion of these separate mysterious facts. In some of the more complicated matters, I might achieve an understanding 5 or 10 days after they were explained to me. But, all in all, I learned much from this initial tour of Europe. The country in Europe which gave us the kindest welcome was Holland, which was a natural outcome of the very special relationship which Japan had enjoyed with Holland for the last 300 years. Moreover, all the members of the mission who knew any foreign language at all had studied Dutch before any other language. So, it made Holland, so far as the use of language was concerned, seem like our second homeland. There was, I recall, an episode which was rather significant. One day in Amsterdam, during a conversation with some merchants and other gentlemen, our envoy chanced to ask the question, "Is the sale and purchase of land in Amsterdam freely permitted?" The reply was, "Certainly, it is free." "Do you sell land to foreigners also?" "Yes, as long as a foreigner is willing to pay for that land, we would sell any amount of it to any person." "Then, suppose a foreigner were to put down a large sum of money to purchase a great tract of land in order to build a fortress. Would you allow that too?" The Hollanders looked puzzled at this and replied, "We never have had occasion to think of such a case. Even though there are many rich men in England and France and other lands, we do not believe any merchant would spend money on such a venture." Neither side understood the other. We interpreters were much amused by this conversation. It is not to be wondered at that Japan was going through a hard struggle when the control and handling of foreign affairs were in the hands of men who exhibited such reasoning in their contact with the West. One ridiculous idea held by our embassy was that its members should not meet the foreigners or see the country any more than they had to. We were under the seclusion theory even while we were travelling in foreign territory. Here, by the way, I have to admit a weakness of mine. I have always been lively and rather inclined to being boastful. But the truth is, I am of a timid nature when it comes to putting a living thing to death or seeing any kind of injury. So, while we were in Russia, this faint-hearted human was taken to see a major surgical operation. My friends, Mizukuri and Matsuki, were eager to go because they were both physicians by profession. They induced me to go along. In the operating room of the hospital, the surgeon, in a kind of raincoat, was giving the patient chloroform on a table, which looked to me like a carving board. Then he took a shining knife and pierced the side of the patient. A tremendous burst of blood shot out on the raincoat of the surgeon. The operation was for a stone. I kept on looking at his movements until he inserted an instrument like a pair of pliers in the wound to lift out the stone. Then I began to grow faint. One of my companions helped me out of the room and gave me water. Ever since we had started on the tour, the anti-foreign movement in Japan had been growing worse, and more blunders were being made in our foreign diplomacy. In Russia, our envoys attempted to settle the dispute over the borderline. I was present at the actual discussion of the dispute, so I know how they ridiculed our protests. Our envoys thoughtfully spread out their map and pointed out that, according to the diagram in which Japanese territory was printed blue and Russian territory red, the borderline would be such and such, therefore Japan would naturally claim all the land within that line. The Russians thereupon retorted that if the colours on the map were to decide the extent of national territory, they could easily claim the whole world by painting the entire map red. This pleasant raillery made it impossible for the Japanese envoys to conclude any argument. Finally, they were obliged to resign their efforts. I felt thoroughly discouraged after sitting through this negotiation. What hope for the future of Japan as long as our people showed this stiff-necked pride, keeping aloof from the actual give and take of the rest of the civilized world? The more this movement of expel the foreigners increased, the more we would lose our national power, to say nothing of prestige. I was mortified when I thought over the possible outcomes of national exclusiveness. One day it happened that I had a conversation, in private, with a member of the reception committee. He drew me alone into a separate room and began to talk of my personal affairs. "I do not know much about Japan. Possibly I am not qualified to speak. But from general reasoning, I feel that Japan is not a country for an ambitious youth. It is a small country, little opportunity for doing big things. What would you say to settling yourself in Russia?" I replied honestly as I felt. "I am in the service of the embassy, I cannot withdraw and stay here as you suggest. Oh yes, you can. Easily, answered the Russian. If you make up your mind to do so, you can. I will hide you somewhere, and the Japanese would not be able to find you. I could strongly recommend you staying, for there are all sorts of occupations here. Your living is assured. There is the chance of making money, even of becoming rich. This was spoken in all seriousness in the quiet of a private room. There was no sign of any pretense or joking. This incident made its impression on me. I had heard that Russia was different from all the other countries of Europe. Now I understood it. For during my visits to England and France, and also in America the year before, nearly all the people I talked with were eager to come to Japan. In fact, I was often bored by having people ask me find them a job in Japan, but I had not met with anyone in those lands who advised me to stay in his country. I could guess from the committee man's eagerness to have me remain in Russia that it was more than a mere personal idea. Probably it was a political or diplomatic scheme. It might even have been an underhanded venture. We returned to France and were about to sail on the return voyage for Japan when news of the Namamugi affair reached us. Suddenly, the entire attitude of Napoleon's government changed. I do not know what may have been the general opinion of people over the affair, but the official attitude was decidedly cool. As we were about to take a boat, we found a guard of honour lined all along the road for a distance of almost a mile. This, we felt certain, was not purely a salute of farewell. It was a subtle demonstration of the French military power as well. Naturally, we did not expect to be fired upon, but this insinuation of ill will was really too much to bear. We drew into Lisbon and Portugal, where the envoys had some mission to complete. Then we entered the Mediterranean, then the Indian Ocean, and finally we returned safely to our native shores. Back in Japan once more, I found the country at the height of the anti-foreign sentiment. All Japan was now hopelessly swept by this anti-Western feeling, and nothing could stop its force from rushing to the ultimate consequence. Until now, this anti-foreign movement had been only an existence in society separate from my personal life. But now, since our return from Europe, the situation had changed. The Ronin were appearing in the most unexpected places. Even some of the merchants engaged in foreign trade suddenly closed up their shops for fear of these lawless warriors. The Ronin were behaving like political ruffians, and there was no telling what they might be doing next.